We are going to be in Matthew chapter 13 today. And I want to start with, can I start with a physics illustration? I haven't done this for a while, but this is actually a story I told you guys a long time ago, but I'm going to tell it anyways. I'm a wannabe physicist. I did do 3 years of engineering undergrad because my dad was an engineer and I, you know, assumed that's what I had to be. I'm way too impulsive to be an engineer, unfortunately. But I loved the physics, especially the conceptual part of it. And really, quite honestly, I love how weird it gets. And thought this may be actually an appropriate place to start, because when we talk about knowledge and what we know, the fact of the matter is there's a lot of assumptions that we make. And that's all right, that's good, that's how we get through life. But something as simple and as fundamental as light really is, in its very nature, something that's still baffling to us. We don't understand it, it's so mysterious. And one of the experiments we did in one of my physics classes was this double slit experiment. I've talked about this before, but has anybody done this experiment? Anyone? Okay, no physicist. Carlin's done it. Okay, you basically are shining light at a screen, and in this screen are a couple little slits that you can open up. And you open up the first slit in the experiment, and then you've got another screen behind that. And so you get this projected image of that slit that shines on the back screen. Okay, it's a little bit bigger. It's because we know that light is composed of these little photons, and they're shooting through this slit, and so they kind of expand a little bit, and you get a little bigger image. Okay, so far, right? So you open a second slit, and what you would expect to find is two slits, but what you find instead is six, okay? And the reason for this is because we know that light is not just composed of little bits of matter, these photons, but it's waves. And as these waves expand towards that screen, they go through these slits, and then they continue as waves. But as those waves expand, they interfere. And those interference, the kind of the troughs and the peaks of this wave, right? It's like if you're splashing water in a pool, all of a sudden you're going to get some really big waves and you're also going to get some flat spots. And that's what that is on that back wall, these six slits. Interesting. And this was really problematic in science. You couldn't be a wave or a particle at the same time. So that was this huge paradox. But it keeps getting weirder because now we have the technology where we can fire a single particle, like a photon, by itself through that. Okay, so you open up one slit, and one at a time, you're shooting these light particles through. And through the single slit, you get that same projection. You open up both slits, now you're firing single particles, and it acts as if there's interference. Okay, now think about that for just a sec. Interfering with what? There's just one single particle. And so as they're doing the math, they're realizing this photon is somehow going through both slits because it's just this probability wave goes through both slits and then hits on the back. Okay, I mean, they're staring at this going, okay, that's really, really bizarre. So somebody's smart enough to go, well, let's put like a camera on the slits. That way we can see which slit it goes through. And when they set that apparatus up, they're able to tell which one it goes through, except all of a sudden, the six lines in the back reduces down to two. Okay, what does that mean? As scientists look at that, they think, somehow, this photon is aware of the choice before it, and it's aware when it's being watched. I'm not kidding. I mean, go Google it, right? I'm telling my friend this, and he's looking at me like, you're insane. And this guy walks up, and he's like, so are you guys here with the conference on cognitive particle augmentation? And I was like, no, I'm a pastor. And he's like, he thought we were physicists, so I felt proud for a moment. And then I told him my sources, and he's like, oh, please, like cosmic banditos and all these, you know, whatever. The point is, all of a sudden my friend looked at me like, wow, you're not crazy. But the thing is that matter, that reality, we think we have this understanding. We flip on a light switch, everything's illumined, the end of the story. But you go, oh no, there's far more going on in the basic fundamentals, the basic fabric of this world that we live in that we have no idea of. And why is that helpful? Well, it should make us hopefully a little more humble about what we know. Secondly, It should point out how easy it is for us to start taking things for granted, things that we feel like we understand that in fact are bigger. Because what happened, like with Einstein, kind of one of the standard bearers of quantum mechanics, which we're talking about here, took a tremendous amount of opposition for his views. See, we thought we had this all dialed in so nice and neat. Newton gave us, you know, here's the nice box, everything fit in. Here's Euclid, or here's the mathematics. We get it. And he's saying, wait, no, there's things actually that we don't get. A willingness to question the limits. Einstein says that he does this because, he did this because basically of a disability that caused him to develop slower than most, which means he was thinking about things like space and time at a later age, and therefore was asking these questions when he was far more aware. Whether or not he's right, certainly he was brilliant. But interestingly enough, that as quantum mechanics kept going, there was a point where he held back. Because as quantum mechanics was pushing towards this idea of everything is just results down to chance, Einstein's famous phrase was, well, you know what, God, I don't think God plays dice with the universe. And he had this ultimate commitment that somehow there is meaning and there is order, and yet within this, maybe we know far less. Maybe truth is bigger than we realize. And I say all of that because I think that in many ways it's a helpful metaphor in thinking about what Jesus was trying to do. Because not scientifically, but spiritually, Jesus came down and was teaching, you know what, you guys, it's bigger. It's bigger than you thought. It's bigger than the law. Our projection unit just overheated. That's what that is. It happens. Bigger, the truth is bigger than we imagine. And so he uses this word, metanoia, the Greek word for repent, which actually, when you look at that word, it has this idea of expanding your knowledge, widening your gaze. It's no surprise that Jesus talks so often about seeing and restoring sight, about hearing. He's saying, can you hear it? It's bigger. Don't be constrained by limited belief. I love Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount. He addresses this in verse 17. If you're there, why don't you just flip over a few chapters to Matthew 5, 17. He says, do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say unto you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, sometimes I think we mistakenly think that Jesus came in and said, you know all those silly rules in the Old Testament? Don't worry about it. None of that applies anymore. We're all off the hook. And I think that what Jesus is saying here is it's actually a lot bigger than those. But it's not as if those are irrelevant. It's just the truth is much bigger. In fact, the righteousness that is required of you is a whole lot higher than just simply following a set of rules. It's a righteousness of the heart. And Jesus is going to go in the next sections and he's going to say, you know, you're so focused on not murdering, which that's good, but your hearts are filled with anger. And that's a big deal. You're so worried about not committing adultery and let in your mind and in your heart are these thoughts of lust. And that's a big deal. The righteousness that is required of my kingdom, the standard that is required, is not just about behavior modification. It's about a new heart, a soft heart, a receptive heart. The righteousness has got to go all the way deep down there because that's the root of the problem, that it's in the hearts of men that the disease is. That's where the cancer is. That's where the cure needs to reach, all the way down there. He's going to tell them that the standard for this is perfection, which should be intimidating to all of us. And yet he's going to tell us in the end of chapter 11 that the burden of it is light. And that the key to this is that we can be yoked with him. The key to it is that Jesus will do it for us, and as it turns out, with us, that his heart will become our heart. Right? Amen. As Jesus is saying all of this, he's also confronting this idea of a focus on, ultimately, focus on behavior is a focus on outward appearance. This is what the Pharisees had just gotten stuck in. How do we look good? And that in doing that, in overlooking the disease of the heart, it can go terribly wrong because that ego is still in there. And so the ego contaminates good behavior and turns it into a way to make ourselves look good, right? We call this like religiosity. And any system can be corrupted when it's just a focus on the outward appearance. Jesus coming in, teaching about the heart, starts flipping their whole paradigm upside down. And he's saying, hey, look, if you want to be the greatest, you guys want to be the greatest, you need to be the least. You want to lead, then you need to be the servant. You want to gain your life, you have to lose it. And this is what the kingdom of the heart looks like. This is what it requires. This is how we step into it. It's a taking up our cross. It's a dying to self. And the Pharisees hate this. What they want is basically a set of rules that they can use to control and manipulate to their own gain. Interestingly enough, I think a lot of the people that are following Jesus at this time aren't very interested in what he's teaching about the kingdom. They just want to see another miracle. And they keep saying, give us another sign. Do that thing again that you did, Jesus. Where you healed that guy, do that again. And so he's seeing this really shallow belief in these fickle sort of followers. And he's looking over here at the opposition, and it's getting stronger and stronger and stronger until the Pharisees are finally like, you know what? Yeah, we acknowledge his power, but he's doing it by witchcraft. And Jesus says, you know what? Be careful. This is in the passage Jay taught on last week, where Jesus is going to say, be careful of these words that you say. Even if they're careless words, they reveal what? The heart. And that there's a point where you go too far. Not a limit of God's love, but a limit of the heart. And that these careless words are revealing a hardness in there. And he's saying, okay, be careful of that. And I think in our passage today, we see Jesus at this place of real vulnerability where he's very discouraged. I think Jesus is probably sitting there with the Father and he's praying, going, what am I going to do? And there's a new strategy that comes out now, a shift in how he's going to minister. And he's going to explain all of that to us here. He's going to do it. We're going to watch him do this new strategy because he's going to start teaching in parables. But this first parable that he's going to teach about here has to do with the state of men's hearts and the attitude of belief. And it's vital for us to hear this message because as much as it applied to them today, it applies to us. What is the condition of our hearts? How fertile is the soil of our hearts? So if you look with me at Matthew 13, we're going to read the first 9 verses here. Says that same day Jesus went out of the house and sat beside the sea. Which is great. Isn't that a great picture? He just went down like to Oak Street and sat down on the beach. Well, this is the Sea of Galilee, actually. But positive ions still, or I don't know. He goes down to a beautiful spot and sits, I'm sure. Spends that time praying. And it says, and great crowds gathered around him, so that he got into a boat. And he sat down, and the whole crowd stood on the beach. And he told them many things in parables, saying, a sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seeds fell along the path, and the birds came and devoured them. Other seeds fell on rocky ground, where they did not have much soil. And immediately they sprang up, since they had no depth of soil. But when the sun rose, they were scorched. And since they had no root, they withered away. Other seeds fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked them. Other seeds fell on good soil and produced grain, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears, let him hear. I'm going to move this down a little bit. Am I feedbacking it all? I feel like a little bit. Okay, keep going. This first parable, I wonder, you know, that people think that they may have found the cove where Jesus taught this way. As people are gathering in, he goes out on a boat, and which from, you know, speaking of physics, this is wonderful acoustics, actually. As he's speaking over the water to this large crowd, they would be able to hear him. There's a cove down there that they call the Cove of Parables, where they think might be the spot, because it would have been a perfect place for Jesus to teach in this way. And it's very possible that he was looking over and actually seeing somebody doing what he's describing there. A lot of the parables that Jesus taught were a little bit from the hip. That he may have looked over and seen somebody scattering seeds, seed birds flying around as he's doing so, and all of a sudden said, okay, you know, let me tell you a story about a farmer sowing seeds. And he's going to tell us in just a little bit that that one sowing the seeds is him, and that those seeds are the Word of God. But this parable isn't about seeds, and it's not about a sower as much as it's about what? Soil, right? And talking about, as Jesus is going around with this message of belief, he's saying vital to your response to this Word of God is a heart of good soil, a heart that is open, a heart that is nurturing. This heart, I think really when it boils down to it, this heart is talking about our will. It's like our chooser, right? I read this one time, I think Peter Kraft said that you got to look at it like the USS Enterprise. You with me, Star Trek? That the mind is like Dr. Spock. And the emotions are like McCoy. Is that the doctor? And the will, the heart, is Captain Kirk. The point being that the mind and the emotions are subject to the captain. That the will has that sort of key role. It's the thing in us that says, so be it. It's the thing that the decider, the chooser, the yes or no. It's that that's been affected. And you see Jesus taking, in these parables, he's taking the cookies off the bottom shelf and he's putting them up on the top shelf. And he's saying, hey, if you've got ears to hear it, listen. And I think what Jesus is doing there is engaging the will. I think this is what's so brilliant about this teaching style, is he's going, the thing that needs healing, you're going to engage it, because the only way you're going to reach that top shelf is if you try for it. He raises the bar up a little bit. To put it down here, it's too easy, it's too accessible, and we're not utilizing, so we're hearing and it's not penetrating, there's no understanding. And so Jesus tells this parable and he leaves them. It's like a riddle. He's saying, go think about it. He who has ears, let him hear. And what is his statement there? Go ponder this. What's the answer? The disciples are going to ask him when he gets like kind of by himself just with those guys. They're going to go, okay, what's the answer, Jesus? Which is great. He's going to go in and explain this to them. Why don't we pick up here in verse 10? Then the disciples came and said to him, why do you speak to them in parables? And he answered them, to you it has been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. For to one who has, more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. This is why I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. Indeed, in their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled that says, you will indeed hear, but never understand, and you will indeed see, but never perceive. For this people's heart has grown dull, and with their ears they can barely hear, and their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and turn, and I would heal them. But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For truly I say to you, many prophets and righteous people longed to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it. Now, when we go through this, this is could feel a little bit complex. Jesus is quoting prophecy. And I wonder if this was kind of revealed to him as Jesus was praying to his Father before the people gathered. You could see Jesus going, Father, why don't they listen? And I think part of the answer given by the Father is, Jesus, this was foretold. This is what Isaiah saw. This is what Isaiah wrote. And this is a little bit like the quantum mechanics, the paradox. How does this work? It almost seems like God is saying, I'm doing something here. He is saying that. And yet at the same time, he's saying there's a responsibility on the part of the hearer. And I think that this is where there's times like this where like the veil gets pulled back a little bit and we're kind of seeing the other side. The classic example to this for me is Peter saying that he won't deny Jesus. And Jesus kind of goes, I'm sorry, Peter, but basically you have already, right? Peter's going, I won't. I'm not going to do this. And you see Jesus almost lovingly say, basically, it's already done, Peter. And you realize what God's perspective must be like versus man's perspective. Because rather than saying it's already been done, it's probably more close that Jesus is saying, I'm watching you do it right now, right? And you see this mind of God, the sovereignty of God and the knowledge of God, and yet you see in that illustration that this doesn't take away the feeling of ownership and responsibility on Peter's part as he weeps for the decision that he makes. And I think belief is like this. There was something that had to happen here. Jesus was going to go to the cross. And the Father saying to Jesus, it's going to happen. They're going to reject it, and you're going to end up there. And yet at the same time, that responsibility is never alleviated from the people. And we see here this dullness of heart, and I think that's such a great word in thinking about what is going on in the heart of men. I remember as I was learning to play guitar, you go through this phase at the beginning where your fingertips just kill, right? Are you with me, any guitar players? And you grow these huge calluses on the tip of your fingers, right, as a way that your body protects itself. And I think that life is like this. Calluses are actually, in some ways, a good thing. It's a way that, again, it's a natural defense. But it's something that, if we're not careful, ends up deadening us. And your fingertips, as those calluses grow, pretty soon you could stab a pin in there and you won't feel it, right? Because of the deadness of that skin. I think this is revealing because I think a lot of the hardness of men's hearts comes from legitimate wounds. And I think that we guard ourselves by this protection, almost this separation, thinking, I'm not going to let that happen to me again. Have any of you ever thought that before? That is never happening to me again. Callous, right? Nobody's going to hurt me like that again, another callous. And this self-protection, while in some regards helpful to us, can get out of control. Especially when it's coupled with an ego that comes in and says, you have no right to do that to me again. Or if you do that to me again, I'm going to do this or whatever. And you get this sort of twisted other voice in there that says, I will never be fooled like that again. I will never hope for something again and be disappointed. And pretty soon this heart is surrounded by all these additional layers of skin. That dullness that says, also, I want to be in control, I want to have it my way, as God prompts and says, move this direction, and you go, no, I'm going to go my own way. But that creates a sort of callous disbelief. Dallas Willard says, whether or not God's will is infinitely flexible, the human will is not. There are limits beyond which it cannot bend back, cannot turn or repent. And in our last chapter, Jay was talking about this, where Jesus says, look, there is a point where you have gone too far. So be careful. But that too far, and I think this was wonderful how Jay brought this up, that too far is not doing something bad enough. That going too far means you have cut yourself off to that point of severing it. So what Jay said, I think, is exactly right. He says, look, if that creates in your heart any sense of fear or apprehension, have I gone too far? You haven't, right? And that's a wonderful piece that comes with that. The one who has gone too far is the one who says, I will never. Even then, hopefully, there's something still beating in that heart. I remember Christopher Hitchens saying that in one of his last interviews. I will never. I just go, oh, still get that guy, God. I think God's still after all the way to the end. There's motives where we distort the truth, where we choose to hear something different. Some of that is self-protection. Some of that, like I said, is the ego. And I think one of the reasons that Jesus puts the cookies on a higher shelf is he's saying, look, this is the truth, but you kind of have to want it. And it's amazing. I mean, that question right there, how much do you want the truth? How much do you want to know the answer? How much do you want? Looking at Joel back there, and it reminds me of a time Joel and I were snowboarding, and he said, hey, do you want me to film you going down the half pipe? And I was like, no. Because I know what I look like up here. I don't want to actually see it. I mean, I feel like I'm like way up there, and I don't want to see the footage. You know, how honest do you want to be? These pictures that don't lie, you know, and I think sometimes we take a slant like that at life. Or we just want to think good things. We want things to tickle our ears. Can you put up this quote by Aldous Huxley? He says this, and I think this is so honest. He says, I had motives. I'm going to wait till we get there. Is it? Oh, darn. Okay, this is a little challenging of one, so you got to lean in, okay? This is supposed to be up here on the board, but anyway. I had motives for not wanting the world to have meaning. Consequently assumed it had none, and I was able without any difficulty to find satisfying reasons for this assumption. Do you get that? He's saying, I didn't want there to be meaning in this world, and I found all kinds of information to help me believe to that end. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in pure metaphysics. He is also concerned to prove there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do. For myself, as no doubt for most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation. The liberation we desired was simultaneously liberation from a certain political and economic system and liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. And I think this quote is so honest that Huxley, brilliant writer and philosopher, is going, you know what, I'm not going to lie. I don't want it to be true because I want to do whatever I want to do. And I think he says what a lot of times we won't articulate. Is that true? I don't know. You know what? I want to pretend it's not. And you see how that is a matter of the heart and something that Jesus doesn't override, that he's healing the hearts of men, which requires our wills to be engaged and our will to be yielded. He's saying it's here and it's planted and it's right there for you. But there has to be a willingness on our part to receive it, to accept it. Jesus is going to explain the types of soil here. And I think this is worth, as we're going through, asking ourselves the question, how is my own heart? In verse 18, Jesus says, hear then the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, The evil one comes and snatches away what has been sown in his heart. This is what was sown along the path. As for what was sown on rocky ground, this is the one who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Yet he has no root in himself, but endures for a while, and when tribulation or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately falls away. As for what was sown among thorns, this is the one who hears the word, but the cares of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it proves unfruitful. As for what was sown on good soil, this is the one who hears the word and understands it. He indeed bears fruit and yields in one case 100-fold, in another 60, and in another 30. There's a few elements to this, and I think it's really it's helpful in understanding, you know what, there's a context here that we need to be aware of, not only the state of our heart, but kind of what is going on around us. The first thing he mentions is the birds. And it's interesting. I mean, this is something that we really don't have a whole lot of access to what is going on there. But these would be distractions to the truth. There's a book by C.S. Lewis called The Screwtape Letters that's filled with all the little cunning plots of the enemy to get us to miss it, right? Like, for instance, in one of them, there's this angel whispering into the guy's ears, like, look, this is a big deal, pay attention. And he's saying, the uncle is writing to his nephew, Demon, saying, don't tell him it's not important. Tell him, no, it's far too important to do on an empty stomach. You should go get something to eat and then think about it later. And he's saying, certainly by the time the guy goes, yeah, that's what I'll do, and goes, gets food, and then the idea's gone. I think that these kind of distractions, I think that it's a reality. I think that, I remember one time I ended up kind of randomly running into my older sister at a coffee shop, and she was there talking to a friend, and I was just the stupid younger brother. Her purse was sitting on a chair, and I thought it'd be funny to just run by and steal her purse and then come back. Ha, 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 here it is. And, of course, she was totally alarmed and, you know, whatever, and then I met her friend and said bye. And she was telling me later that she was actually witnessing to her friend right at that moment where I had snagged the purse. And I was like, oh, I'm so embarrassed. And she was saying, and my sister, who was just such like the evangelist, but she was saying, oh, it happens every time, Jeff. It happens every time. I was the bird, I guess, in that situation. But the idea that as we're sharing our faith or sharing belief, you could count on distraction, opposition, something to come in and interrupt. And I think that really is true. A lot of that we speculate. Who knows exactly what that looks like each time? But certainly there's a plan to distract, to snatch that away. The rocky soil here, what is that? That's probably, I think in Galilee, which actually has some really fertile soil for crops, there are sections of it where there's this layer of limestone a couple inches down. And so if the farmers have not tilled the soil well, they don't know about it. They just scatter the seeds. And as it turns out, it springs up, looks great, looks like a good crop, and then it all dies. It hasn't sunk the roots down deep enough to receive the nutrients that it needs. And so the sun scorches it. And as we see here, this has this idea of perseverance. I remember when I was working at Forest Home, I was there for a couple years as an intern, which meant when there wasn't programs, I'd kind of find stuff to do. And I was helping the landscaper as he was planting some new trees. And he said, oh, Jeff, be careful not to water those too much. And I was like, water too much? What do you mean? And he said, well, if you give them too much water, what you do is you train them to keep their roots right at the surface. The water is too readily available. It's too accessible. And the problem with that is the first real windstorm that comes is going to knock all the trees over. It'll just uproot them. That they have to reach deep, sink deep roots in order to gain stability and strength. This is a great picture. I think Jesus is looking at the people that are like hungry for the next sign, the next display of power. And I think there's a caution for these people here where he's saying, you know what? Those are all good things, but you're going to need roots. Why? Well, the Christian life, I think, is filled with difficulty, challenge, opposition. And Jesus is saying, in order to endure those things, You need roots. Roots of perseverance, roots of self-control, roots of courage. If you're just taking it as the next fly-by-night fun thing to do, it won't last. And the kind of belief is not just some sort of spontaneous commitment, but a life that is given. It's discipleship. Another little bit from Screwtape Letters there is saying that Jesus will step back like a parent does from a child that's learning to walk, so that we'll learn to take our first steps, and that those first steps come with that sense of like imbalance and doing it on our own. And yet they're vital because Jesus has got plans for us to grow legs so that we can stand, that we can walk, to be like him. The thorns are the next illustration. And I think the thorns are something that I think for all of us require us to be really honest. The thorns are these things that come in that steal the life, that steal our will, our desire, our heart away from God. And what these things do is they choke us. They take that life, they take that seed, and they quench it. Our possessions, our success, our ego, our control, all of these things have the potential to be thorns. We were just out in the garden the other day. It's springtime, pulling weeds up, pulling all these out. And, you know, it allows for there to be the proper nutrients in the soil, the room to grow. It pulls those harmful things out. And I think that it's the president. Hello. I did that in a class one time. We just said, hello. And the teacher looked at me in shock, and I was like, just kidding. The distractions, the birds, that was one of those little birds. The thorns that come, I think that we need to be gardeners of our heart. And I think that means being honest there and seeing what are the things that choke. Material possessions really are benign unless they've somehow clutched onto us and are robbing us of something. And that's it. I mean, we're talking about the heart here, so we're talking about the will. What are the things that you cling to? What are the things that you can't live without? Those are the things, actually, the only things really that threaten. The things that you won't let go of. Those are the things where Jesus is saying, okay, let go of that. Give that to me. I mean, we're going to have some time at the end of this service just to pray and to minister. But if these things, if you find these things on your heart, what a great opportunity to come forward and say, you know what? I want God to weed that out. Those things, when we release them like that, they pull up really nicely. But it requires humility. It requires honesty. I think it requires our whole mind to be engaged. And this is sometimes, you know, as far as sinking the roots in all of this, it requires us to be smart. And I don't mean like a certain IQ. I mean like an applying. We read we sang it in that passage. To love God with all your mind. For the will to take your mind and to do battle, to wage war with it. I love this quote by Lewis. He said, God is no fonder of intellectual slackers than of any other slacker. If you are thinking of becoming a Christian, I warn you, you are embarking on something which is going to take the whole of you, brains and all. But fortunately, it works the other way around. Anyone who is honestly trying to be a Christian will soon find his intelligence being sharpened. One of the reasons why it needs no special education to be a Christian is that Christianity is an education itself. That is why an uneducated believer like Bunyan was able to write a book that has astonished the whole world. And we're talking about this idea of seeing reality, the closedness of the Pharisees that were unwilling to see beyond. And yet what God wants to instruct us in is the way things really are. God is stretching our minds, stretching our hearts, stretching us to be like him, giving us a new heart, a heart like his. And so David prays, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thought. See if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. And this question I pose to you is the same. How is your heart? Do you long for understanding? Do you long for truth? I love these verses from Proverbs. Hear, O son, a father's instruction, and be attentive that you may gain insight. For I give you good precepts. Do not forsake my teaching. He says, let your word hold fast my words. Keep my commandments and live. Get wisdom, get insight. Do not forget and do not turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her and she will keep you. Love her and she will guard you. The beginning of wisdom is this, get wisdom. And whatever you get insight. Prize her highly and she will exalt you. She will honor you if you embrace her. She will place on your head a graceful garland. She will bestow on you a beautiful crown. This is why Jesus says to the disciples, blessed are you. That this wisdom, this insight, really is the voice of God. We're told in the Sermon on the Mount that the ones who hear, the ones who see God are the pure in heart. That's what we come to today as a place, not some legalistic structure of trying to prove that we're good, but with hearts that say, God, I want your wisdom. I want your understanding. It tells us in James, he gives it freely for any who ask. Isn't that great? He gives it in abundance. Some of the things that hold us back, past wounds that we've received, I think that would be another area to come forward and get prayer on today, is unforgiveness, bitterness. That stuff is like infection in our hearts. So many of us are waiting for that apology that's never going to come. And God is saying, give that over, forgive. That could be one of the best things to do today, is if God calls to mind an area where you are not forgiving. The deceit of the thorns is this distortion of reality that says you're in control. And the fruit of that, it says in that passage, is anxiety. Be another way that we see a heart that is not fully given over, where we are trying to control and to hold on. One of my mentors, she always tells me in those situations, Jeff, you need to be asking, okay, God, where are you in this situation? Because he's yoked to us if we're his follower. He's there. What are we doing, God? What is the plan here? Instead of me going, let me figure this out. So I want to read these verses from Philippians to close. And in just a second, I'll have the ministry team and elders come forward. And we really would love to just pray and minister with you today. Things that God has brought up to your heart. But Jesus tells us again and again to set our minds on things above, to the greater reality. And I think in these verses in Philippians, he explains how to do that. He says, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your heart and your mind in Christ Jesus. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. What you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. I love that prayer in Mark 9 where the man, Jesus is there and the man is saying, will you heal my sister? And he says, if you believe. And he says, I do believe. Help my unbelief. And I think that's a prayer that we can all pray. That we say, God, I do believe. Help my unbelief. Would you stand with me? And if you're part of the ministry team, I just ask you to come forward at this time. The elders come forward at this time. And I'm going to ask Terry to close us in prayer.